So, our speaker for the topic of how do people's ideas change, an important question for socialists who want to change ideas, is Emma Norton. Emma Norton's a long-standing member of Socialist Alternative, highly active in a number of campaigns, currently based in Sydney, but has come all the way down to Melbourne, much like many of you, to participate in this conference. Emma's going to do a talk, an introduction, make some arguments about a Marxist analysis of the process of transformation of people's ideas. Afterwards, we'll have time for discussion, and we want as much discussion as possible, and that means everyone in this room should be thinking throughout Emma's talk about their own opinions, your own opinions on what she's saying, things that you may want to raise, questions, comments, disagreements, and so on. After Emma's finished, we'll have time for discussion. For now, please welcome Emma.
Ooh. Right. Well, cool. Well, there are clearly a lot of bad ideas out there. Probably don't need to tell the people in this room that. And I think for left-wing people, it can be seen like a huge issue, really the crux of the issue in some ways. There's a lot of ignorance, prejudice, greed and hatred out there. And it seems like, I think, in our society, things are getting worse, not better. There's often an idea that floats around that ideas just progressively improve, you know, as we discover new things about the world, as people, you know, become more enlightened. And yet what we're seeing is really the opposite in the world today, a new odious far right who idolise Hitler and are calling for a new Holocaust of Muslims are really on the rise across the world, including here in Australia. Some of them have put violent fantasies into action, carrying out massacres in Christchurch, Charlottesville, Charleston, Pittsburgh, Quebec City, and the list goes on. Governments as well are filling up with far right loons, and their ideas seem to be propagating a lot more than the left's. So we have Anning here. If you're from New South Wales like me, you have Mark Latham to deal with now, and actually two senators from the One Nation Party in the New South Wales Senate. Even in New Zealand, the Labor Party there is in coalition with an anti-migrant right-wing party. And, of course, who could forget Donald Trump and all the other far-right loons who are kind of gaining ground across the world. So clearly ideas do matter. They're powerful, as has become a kind of ubiquitous phrase in the world. And how they change is important. And this question of what ideas are, how do they form, how do they change, has basically been the domain of philosophy throughout history. And there's been a kind of consensus over the last few hundred years about this question, that basically ideas are formed by clever people at the top of society, learned people who go to universities, who think, who write books and so on. And they change ideas en masse by educating others. That's kind of just the accepted idea about this question. So this was an idea that became quite popular a few hundred years ago, and Marx was one of the people who really tried to combat it. He thought, he kind of mounted two main critiques against it. He said that, first of all, these philosophers who argued this didn't understand that their philosophies were actually rooted in their own context. They weren't just giving birth to beautiful brain children, but they were representing the ideas of their class, of their time, and of their mode of production. And this is true of lots of philosophers throughout history. Plato, you know, thought he was an absolute genius. His main contribution to philosophy was that philosopher kings should reign over society, and that they, you know, would kind of understand the world in a way that the masses couldn't possibly. But this wasn't just an idea he had. This was based on the mode of production that he was a part of, one based on slavery and the rule of a thin upper caste of intellectuals. John Locke, who's one of my least favourite philosophers in the 1700s, was trying to do the same. He was trying to justify his own society and the naturalness of the capitalist society that he was a part of. So he, you know, justified the kind of his class's obsession with scientific knowledge, the idea that a tiny elite could come to a full understanding of the world and educate the masses beneath them. So for philosophy for Marx was not a series of clever ideas thought up by geniuses. They were contextual, they were political, people's ideas were based on the kinds of societies they lived in. His other critique was that these philosophers who talked so much about ideas and changing them didn't really want to change society. They often, their philosophies were just kind of descriptions and accommodations with existing society, justifying the rule of the classes that they were a part of. Marx was a rebel, like hopefully the people in this room, and he wanted to change society completely. And for him, this meant understanding the material basis of ideas in society. So that basically both the ideas and the actual material conditions that bred them could be simultaneously changed. So I'm going to talk about the material basis of ideas in society, where they actually come from. They don't pop out of thin air. They don't come about because people have, a brainwave. They come from the actual society that we live in. So the starting point for Marx was that, and for the analysis of ideas and philosophy, he said it should start at the level of the real individuals, their activity, the material conditions under which they live, both those which they find already existing and those produced by their activity. So for him, the intellectual life of individuals and their society was dependent on the way that they produced basically their means of subsistence, produced the things that they needed to live, the way they organised production and so on. And we know this is true on the most basic and obvious level. Like, people often cite that thing about various cultures that, you know, who are based in kind of very snowy areas, like Norway, Sweden and Finland. Their languages have like a million different words for snow and types of snow and tracks in snow. So clearly, you know, the ideas and culture and languages that human beings create do not pop out of thin air. They're based on their actual experience. But this is true on a much deeper level as well. A particularly good example of what I'm talking about, I think, are the classless societies, so indigenous societies around the world that unfortunately for them came into contact with European colonial powers in the colonial era. And you see the ideas of these societies that were egalitarian, that were classless, that didn't have sexual oppression, come into contact with the really sexist, elitist European societies and their worship of private property. So a few examples of this. One of my favourites is when colonial scientists in America first tried to give Sioux Indians IQ tests, they found that they couldn't stop the Native Americans from collaborating with each other to try to do the IQ test together. And the Indians couldn't figure out why they weren't allowed to work together to get the answers. Their society obviously stressed cooperation, not competition, and so it just seemed bizarre that you would try to separately measure the IQ of each individual. In Sydney, as well, when the First Fleet came, there was an Indigenous woman leader named Barangaroo, who's quite famous now, and she was invited to watch the flogging of an Irish convict, and he'd actually stolen her and some other women's canoes, and so his punishment by the colonial authorities was flogging. When she saw this, she was shocked and appalled, like had no idea why he was being punished at all, and she grabbed a big stick and tried to kill the executioner with it. And there's many examples like that, but Aboriginal Australians didn't understand why you would need to violently protect private property in such a way. They didn't have the same concept of private property. They would often leave their storehouses and stuff without any guard, without anyone to guard it for years on end. Knowing that if anyone used anything, they probably just needed it and it wasn't something you had to protect with violence. So obviously human societies, many of them developed from these classless origins into class-divided groups. And ideas developed in accordance with this. So we know of some of them, like in feudalism, the divine right of kings was enshrined in the ideas of those societies. So everyone had their rightful place from the king all the way down to the mere serf. Ancient Egypt, as everybody probably knows, worshipped the monarchy, the kings, as virtual deities, and a lot of their ideas were all about enshrining the rule of a very thin layer of people in a vicious slave society. So what about capitalism? When you live inside a society, it can be a little bit harder to notice the ideas that that justify it and come from it. But I wanted to talk about the material basis of ideas under capitalism. And Marx is useful here as well. He said that the dominant ideas of any class society are those of the ruling class, which makes sense. They rule, they get to own all of the things that churn out ideas and get to make all the rules. So it makes sense that their ideas tend to dominate, at least. Under capitalism, the ruling class are the people who own the means of production. So, factories, offices, universities like this one. And these are the capitalists and their cronies. These are people who live off the exploitation of the vast majority, who they constantly seek to discipline and control. They commodify absolutely everything in society, including human labour, from the water we drink, the food we eat, trees, mountains, everything is mere commodities to be extracted and sold for a profit. So they're a class for which nothing can be free. Everything must be owned and traded, for whom resources and global control of markets are fought over in destructive wars. So that's important to say. This is the class that shapes the ideas, the dominant ideas of our society, and has done for over two centuries. So John Locke, who I mentioned at the start, the philosopher, I don't know if people have been forced to read this guy in their first year philosophy classes. He's usually one of the first that you come into contact with. As well as telling people to really trust in the scientific elite's ability to empirically understand everything about the world, he also insisted that private property should be enshrined in law, should be protected with brutal violence, and even private property in the form of slaves, actually, which he owned himself. He was an early capitalist and wealthy investor in the slave trade. So while in your first year philosophy class, you might be taught that this guy just had some interesting ideas, aren't they fascinating, let's explore them, he was very much trying to defend a society that was, you know, the brutal early capitalist society he was a part of. So the ideas that justify capitalism are the ideas of this class. The kind of tenets of the holy scripture of capitalist ideas, of liberalism, are that private property is sacred, that we're all atomized individuals, and we are in a way. This, you know, is enforced in our daily lives under capitalism. We have our individual bank accounts. We relate to each other as buyers and sellers on an impersonal market. We must all compete as well. This is a typical idea that justifies capitalism. And again, it's part of daily life. Bosses compete for profit on the market. Workers compete for jobs. At school and university, we're forced to compete with each other to the point that we're literally like ranked from the, you know, one to however many school children there are in Australia. Countries even compete over global control and resources. And the other kind of final tenet, which is less about what we actually experience under capitalism and more about what the capitalists want us to do, is that you have to work hard. That hard work brings, everything good in the world. And it obviously suits a ruling class to have this idea be one of the central kind of core tenets, given that its wealth only increases as workers are made to work harder and for less. And I think as well, capitalism has added other kind of, core tenets, I guess, as it's, had to figure out how to run the system. So dividing the people that you exploit in a million and one ways, justifying war and hyper-exploitation using racism, nationalism, and so on, ideas like homophobia and sexism have all come to play a really important role in the continuation of capitalism. And this is kind of when people think of like common sense ideas, I think it's important to say these, again, don't just drop out of thin air, but they come from this this lived reality of ordinary people. So ideas which seem to reflect that lived reality seem to make sense to people. They wouldn't make sense to a classless society, obviously, but to people living under capitalism, things like it's a dog-eat-dog world just makes sense. That's kind of true. People are naturally greedy, that kind of thing. If you look up inspirational quotes on the internet, as I did, you'll find similar. You'll find, these are kind of the common sense ideas that are just meant to make us feel, nice, and they just make sense. Success is no accident is one of them. If you're really wealthy, you worked hard to get there. There's no substitute for hard work. This is my favourite. Don't say you don't have enough time. You have exactly the same number of hours per day that were given to Mother Teresa, Thomas Jefferson, Albert Einstein. Admittedly, a lot of the hours that Jefferson got were probably thanks to his 600 African slaves. But these ideas don't just come from our daily lived experience. They're also propagated purposefully in the system. It obviously takes labour, machines, reach, institutions to propagate ideas, and almost all of these are owned or controlled in some way by the ruling class, the people with an interest in continuing capitalism and therefore an interest in propagating pro-capitalist ideas. Even if it's not the most right-wing ones, it's at least pro-capitalist ideas. So the education system, the media, the kind of culture machine, even social media platforms and the government, all of these institutions tend to propagate pro-capitalist ideas, and they tend to ignore or discipline people who hold views which might challenge this norm. So in Australia, I think we have one of the most grotesque examples of this in the media. The Australian print media is 90% controlled by two people, basically, Rupert Murdoch and... what's his name? Who just bought out Fairfax? Someone will think about that. Who said it? Yeah, Packer. That's it. generally, to produce any form of media, even more kind of cultural products like movies, TV and art, you need a lot of money, you need to know the right people and so on. So obviously the ideas that we get from Murdoch and Fairfax, even if they differ and have little fights amongst themselves, they're all pro-capitalist. And you can see this a lot in how people espousing ideas which challenge these dominant ones are really punished, ridiculed or ignored. So witness the targeting of left-wing academics. We've had a lot of it here, actually. Remy Kanazi not being allowed into the country. We saw in this country Yasmin Abdel-Magid basically driven out of both the media that she worked for and then pretty much out of the country as well, where she pretty much couldn't get a job as a journalist anymore because the right went so on the offensive against her. Meanwhile, the far right, which doesn't actually challenge any of these central tenets of capitalism that I've talked about, doesn't challenge the dominant racism, sexism and pro-capitalist ideology of the mainstream, they're treated more as like a fun curiosity to be given as much of a hearing as possible. And a lot of people kind of think that social media could be a salve to this, and obviously to some extent it has been. But I think it's important to witness how, like everything in capitalist society, it has quickly been monopolised and commodified. So advertising is now non-stop. A tiny number of platforms exist and they're controlled by huge corporations. Companies can like buy likes and followers on Facebook, that kind of thing. And now more and more we're seeing that all of these platforms are being policed by the corporations that run them and by the state itself. So there's a number of governmental regulations, censorship by Facebook and Twitter basically happening all the time. So the other place that we get a lot of our ideas from are the education system. And I think it's important to say that schools are some of the least free places in society, the least open kind of forums for debate. They really are kind of next to prisons and workplaces in their kind of lack of freedom. You have no right to question what you're being taught or why, or to demand to be taught something else. And really, schools are disciplinary institutions where the main thing you learn is to do as you're told, not to think for yourself. And if you think of who actually writes the curriculum for example, the Australian education system, it's people like Keith Windschuttle. I don't know if anyone knows this absolute scumbag, but Howard got Keith Windschuttle to write the history curriculum. Now, Keith Windschuttle is a historian who is famous for denying that there had ever been any genocide of Aboriginal people in Australia. The well-known and well-documented Indigenous genocide in Tasmania he thought was made up. He got to write the history curriculum. So to the extent that you do learn about anything that might challenge capitalism, anything a bit left-wing, it's usually to put you off, the intention is. So people who learn about the Russian Revolution and Stalin and so on, it's usually taught as a cautionary tale. And also, we're never taught about, for example, the labour movement in this country or Indigenous resistance to colonisation or things that might actually inspire people to think that a different, you know, that struggle is good or that a different world is possible. And even the seemingly less ideological things are kind of infected with this. The English curriculum, which I've had the pleasure of teaching a little bit of recently, has a weird amount of bush poetry in it, for example, which no one is really interested in, but is all about kind of drumming up a strange, Australian nationalism. In physics, you learn about how great nuclear power is all the time. They really push that, actually. Universities are similar. They're funded by corporations and by the government. If you're too left-wing, you can be sacked, as at Sydney University, a pro-Palestinian lecturer was actually recently sacked for criticising Israel. Most of the funding as well that goes into universities, apart from coming from the government, comes from corporations. So often it goes towards destructive research or just towards the, endlessly churning out business students. And also I think it's important to say that universities, while they are kind of more mass now, lots of people attend university in Australia, they're still quite elite institutions and the people that run them consider themselves so. So they tend to produce, even at their best, even in the kind of more left-wing sociology and history departments, they tend to produce quite elitist ideas about how to change the world. This obviously doesn't mean that we should be anti-education, it's worth saying. It's always a contradictory thing to give poor people and exploited and oppressed people any tools to understand and critique the world. Slaves were not really given the ability to read in America, but they were given Christianity, which they turned into a way to try to rebel against slavery. So, you know, we can maybe think of that as an analogy for going to university under capitalism. A bit dodgy, really, but... yeah, I mean, and you think about it, like the left-wing high school climate strike. Obviously, a lot of school kids have been taught about climate change. They know it's wrong. They know it's terrible. They want to do something about it. Universities have constantly suffered campus rebellions over the course of history. It's just that the institutions themselves usually try to curb those. So we saw that with principals telling off their students who wanted to go on the climate strike recently. Lots of students at universities have had to fight, including Daniel, have had to fight for, you know, free speech on their campus, just the right to hand out a leaflet or go to a protest or whatever. So basically this is why ideas are so crap, because we live in a society that is so crap. And its continuation is really based on the continuing rule of a really crap ruling class who propagate their ideas in a million ways. So question of how they change. Thankfully, liberalism has its own idea about how they should change. Basically, like I said before, that people are educated by you know, elites. And I think it's important to say this is a really elitist doctrine. The thing that Marx asked when he was kind of arguing against people who argued the same thing was, who will educate the educators? If you have a society that produces ideas that justify the rule of the ruling class, that people who are, you know, pleasing to the ruling class and churn out pro-capitalist ideas, these are the kinds of people in a position to propagate ideas, then how on earth will you educate them to want to change society? And I think it's also worth saying, like, we don't live... Oh, hang on, sorry. Well, another aspect of this is that what it's trying to do is lay the blame at the feet of the masses of ordinary people. Basically, they're all ignorant, and that's why anything bad happens in the world. It's the stupidity of the masses. I think there's a few arguments against this. Like, firstly, we don't live in much of a democracy at all, so it's really not because the masses have ideas at all that that, you know, particular policies are put in place. If you did actually ask the masses of people a series of questions and allow them to make decisions based on the ideas that they currently hold, we would already live in a way, way better society. All of the polls show that people are far to the left of their ruling classes on pretty much every question. Every time we have gotten a say as well, it's worth saying, we've made the right decision. Marriage equality was won by basically polling the Australian population. Abortion was won in Ireland. Indigenous rights were won partly through a referendum here in Australia, and also conscription was voted down twice in Australia when it was actually put to the people. So bad ideas, I think, definitely come from the top and are propagated from the top of society. And you only have to think of, like, Islamophobia and the way that has just become, in the last 30 years, this serious prop of the capitalist class in Australia and around the world, to see how quickly these bad ideas can be propagated amongst the population if the ruling class decides to do so. So I want to talk about the masses of people and the working class and our ideas, because I don't think we just passively absorb all of these crap ideas from on high, even if we do accept some of them. The reason why we do accept some of them is that they do accord with our daily experience of life. In a world where private property, competition, discipline, war and racism are just daily realities. When we go to work, we're pitted against each other, we're told we're too dumb to make important decisions about the world, we're told that we're barely worth the wages we're paid, we're told what to do and what to wear and how to act and so on. When we go home, we're atomised and powerless. The media and government tell us to blame each other for this state of affairs, blame the Muslims, blame the migrants, blame the dole bludgers. And people often take out their frustrations on each other, while corporations and politicians just seem to constantly get off scot-free. So there is a reality to people accepting these ideas. But I think this is a really contradictory process. There's another side to being a working class person which is special, something which can't help but put us in opposition to the ruling class and to their ideas. So the nature of our work is that it forces us together into massive cities, into huge workplaces, at, you know, universities, factories, warehouses, offices, shopping centres, that kind of thing. So we're a kind of automatically a bit of a collective class. The working class as well is multicultural. It's men and women. It's LGBTI. It's much more of a cross-section of humanity, actually, than the ruling elites, who are much more a kind of monotonous shade of white. So workers are, for example, more likely to have interracial marriages. And in a lot of polls, actually, and this is not kind of what you're taught in university, but in a lot of polls, are less racist than middle-class people and rich people. We're more egalitarian and collectivist because it's in our interest to be so. So we donate more of our money to charity than the rich. We're consistently to the left in polls on government policy like welfare and healthcare and taxes. For example, and again, you don't really get this sense from reading kind of media stories, but the vast bulk of the American population are against Trump's wall and for free education and healthcare. If you tell anyone what the Green New Deal is, for example, in America, and poll them on whether or not they're into it, 80% of people are into it. So people are naturally, I think, understand that their interests are much to the left of their rulers. But the other really important aspect of being a working class person is that you're forced to rebel against society. First of all, because our experience of capitalism often becomes intolerable. Exploitation by its nature has to be inhuman and soul-crushing. Nothing about the enjoyment or satisfaction of the worker really goes into the equation because everything is done for a profit. And because the capitalists compete against each other for profit, they even have an interest in making our lives progressively worse. And you've seen this over the last 30 years. Things haven't just gotten better because Australia has gotten more wealthy. It's just gotten more unequal. And now we have wages stagnating and even falling and so on. So that need by the capitalists to squeeze every last drop out of workers actually pushes us to rebel. The other thing is that to the extent we do get anything good or dignified in the world or get to experience a scrap of humanity, it's because we or someone else before us struggled for it. We've lost a lot, like I said, because of a lack of struggle over the last 30 years, even with a booming budget. Now there's a budget surplus, as the government can't stop telling us. And yet we've lost the eight-hour day, we've lost decent pay, the ability to buy a house for most ordinary people is slipping away fast. And then we have won some things recently, and we weren't just given them out of the kindness of the hearts of the people in power. It wasn't because they just woke up one day and decided they were more left-wing. But we won with an almighty struggle, marriage equality in this country. We stopped the Liberals from deregulating university fees a few years ago as well. So the fact that you have a class in society which is fucked over by the oppressive system of capitalism, forced together into big cities, forced to work together collectively and produce for a tiny minority, and that majority of people can only advance our interests by fighting against the system, it becomes a real powder keg, and it is. So I want to talk about struggle, because that really is what Marx thought could transform mass consciousness very rapidly, actually. While the ruling class will continue to have their pro-capitalist ideas that are about continuing their system, the masses of people can and do transform themselves in the midst of struggle. Now, it's kind of unimaginable how transformative struggle can be unless you've taken part in it. But I've got a few historical examples we can look at. My favourite one is from the German Revolution. There were a lot of shell-shocked soldiers after World War One, or during World War One in Germany. They were in Berlin, they were in hospitals, having had their legs blown off in the trenches, and obviously completely scarred and had what we would now call PTSD. When the revolution started in 1918, according to a Berlin doctor working in a hospital for shell-shocked soldiers, he said that the soldiers just suddenly got out of their beds and left and just joined the revolution outside. And he said that by his, calculations as a doctor or whatever, they'd actually been cured and many of them had lost their madness and they'd just gone to join the revolution that was about stopping the war, which had torn apart their bodies and brains. So, yeah, revolutions can be very transformative. They can transform individuals and create leaders from ordinary working class people as well. We've seen this a little bit in the West Virginia teachers' strike, if people have been kind of following that over the last couple, that was last year, but and there have been teachers' strikes around the US. And you can start to feel like the masses of people, not individual saviours from on high, can actually change the world. So one of the leaders of the West Virginia strike said that new leaders were the people who did not have a title. They'd maybe been complacent, not really playing an active role. We learned that you don't have to have a title, you don't have to have a position, you just have to have courage and a backbone to stand up for yourself, your state and your kids. So the other thing that can happen in the course of struggle is that people become extremely politicised. It raises all these questions when you're trying to fight for even a basic demand. And debates can rage, people can radicalise, and their ideas can rapidly change. So we saw this in the 1960s, where a left really flourished in around 1968 and after across the world. Ideas that had previously been off-limits or laughable, like revolution, like socialism, become standard discussion in classrooms and on the streets and at protests. And once you realise that you can say, have a say over society, the temptation to go further is irresistible. One of my favourite examples of this is in May 1968 in France, where the workers at the Renault factory would kind of unveil a banner each day during one of their massive strikes in May 1968. The first banner said for higher wages and better pensions. This is their kind of key demand. The second banner the next day, they took that down and they put up a new one, and it said for a socialist party, communist party, trade union government. So they'd had some debates, clearly, the night before. They decided higher wages, let's aim a little bit higher. The next day they took that down and they put for workers' control of production up. Within 3 days, clearly, they had radicalised to the point of thinking that workers should just take over the world and run it themselves. The other things, so lots of common sense ideas are challenged in the course of revolution, and some of the most important ones that are challenged are those divisive ideas that keep people apart and keep people oppressed. We've seen that across the Arab Spring, both in 2011 and the ones happening today. But I wanted to go back to an example from 2014 in Bosnia, where there was a big uprising against the government and the local governments in a country where, there's extreme poverty. I think there was about 40% unemployment in 2014 when this uprising happened. Now, Bosnia had just had its civil war only a couple of decades ago that was absolutely devastating, where Serbs, Croats and Muslim workers were all pitted against each other in a really vicious war. And when this uprising, and you've got to say as well, like the whole political system is divided between Serbs, Croats and Muslims in Bosnia. And yet, when this uprising happened, you could see protesters holding signs reading, "We are hunger in three languages," and "Muslims, Serbs and Croats are here together. How are you going to distract us now?" And they took down not just the leaders of one particular party or one particular ethnic group, but leaders from all of the ethnic groups had to stand down, had to quit, lest they, stoke the revolution any further. So you learn a lot in struggle. You learn that, the people around you are comrades in arms, not people, scapegoats or whatever. You learn about the role of the state, the police, how the ruling class rules, basically, and how it keeps people down. And revolutions really only advance, and workers can only advance in struggle if they actually learn those lessons. And so their ideas can change extremely rapidly. So the basic thing is that as workers challenge the system, they change themselves as well. And as Marx said, they become fit to rule society anew. So I'll start to wind up, but I think it's important to say that none of this process is automatic. People aren't automata. They don't just kind of, stumble through a revolution and suddenly at the end they're these perfect revolutionary beings. They learn all of this through debate, through assessment, through victories and defeats. And the contradictory ideas that we hold under capitalism, those two tendencies of kind of pro-capitalist ideas and the ones that challenge them, can exist simultaneously in the heads of people. So which ideas come to dominate movements, which win out, which, become the new strategy for a struggle or for a revolution, is not a foregone conclusion. It is the outcome of these debates. And I think for that reason it's so important that people actually get organised today. This is a really central argument that you need a revolutionary organisation, a revolutionary party that can be a part of all of those debates, that has thought about this before, that has, become the kind of historical memory of the struggles that have come before. So you need to actually fight for the right ideas in the here and now in order to win in the future. But I think that fight, it's important to say, is not just one that happens in rooms like this, not just one on campuses or whatever, but a practical one that happens on the streets, on campuses, on in our workplaces, just as much as it does in rooms like this.
Thank you.